history lesson this time, we reviewed four Air Force spots for Sets of Verses. What did you get out of 2 Samuel 7:11b through 16, which is God's covenant with David? What did you see in that covenant?
That it was a perpetual covenant.
That really is the bottom line, isn't it? That it was a forever covenant. And what was the covenant? Just kind of...
That there would always be a king on the throne from the tribe of Judah.
So when we look at that, that is a promise, which we are, it seems, tested in this particular lesson because we have a woman who's kind of taken over that role. But she's still from that tribe. She's from a couple of different things. No, she isn't. She's Jezebel and Ahab.
She's in Sidon. No, she isn't.
Ahab's wife.
Yeah.
Daughter, yeah.
She's, yeah, but her mother was from...
Her mother was? I don't even remember who her mother was. Okay. So, but she is also like this parenthesis. It's going to get back on track. She's a parenthesis.
Yeah.
It's almost like God is waiting for that baby to get old enough to put him on the throne. And you think about it, because we're going to get to Josiah. Josiah became king at 8. And they had a consort with him until he reached a certain age. And in this case, he continues on with the high priest. No, with the prophet, excuse me. It's so funny when I listen to him, I have to remember, this is not a priest, this is a prophet. Okay, so, and he also said, I will give you rest from your enemies, and the Lord will make a house for you, he will establish his kingdom, he will raise up their descendants, he shall build a house for my name, the person, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom. This is all in 2 Samuel. Forever, so the throne. I will be a father to them, and he will be a son to me. And when he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart. As I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you, your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. So the foundation of that relationship is stable. Well, you guys are moving all over the place. It's okay. So I'm done.
The world.
I usually don't pay attention when people move because I really believe we ought to be able to get up and go to the bathroom and get coffee and everything you want. Or if somebody has to leave, they have to leave or whatever. But when several of you get up, it's like this. All of a sudden, the...
Half of them are gone.
We're in excess.
The birds are flying all around and making whoopee sounds.
Sorry.
What?
Made connections to meet somebody at a certain time here.
So, 2 Kings 8, 19 and 25 through 29. What did we learn there?
I thought he... You know, that it concisely said he had promised him to give a lamp to him through his sons always.
So we know he repeats this promise, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. And he keeps repeating this problem. They're not the light, but they are a lamp. And then 25 through 29, we get a little bit about Joram and the son of Ahab of Israel and Ahaziah. Joram, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaziah was 22, and he did, and his mother name was Athaliah. I don't have a clue why that was in that particular spot. So, because he walked in the way of the house of Ahab. And just in the beginning, to remind us, what is walking in the house of Ahab? Because we also have walking in the ways of Jeroboam. So what is walking in the way of the house of Ahab mean?
Baal worship.
So he brought Baal worship in. It was peripherally there with his father, but he brought it in as a way of worship. And what is the way of Jeroboam?
calves.
The two calves.
Oh, yes, the golden calves.
Yeah. And so it's an idolatrous, false relationship, but it isn't a specific one like we have with Baal. And who goes along with Baal? Who is Baal's cohort? We get into that today, but we've had it before, too. Who is the cohort of Baal?
Oh, that Asherim?
Yes. So we begin to see why Asherim is brought into this particular time zone. And when they talk about the Baals after the time of Ahab, they're always saying they didn't take the high places down. Even if, like, Jehu came in, we had him come in, and we had him wipe out the evil temple, etc., but he still did not take down the high places. And the reason I want to make, we've heard this all the way through our study. We did a lot of great king, did this good, you know, but he didn't take down the high places. Who is the one who takes down the high places? Or says to take down the high places?
God says it.
God says it. But with man, we would think, at least I would think, it would be like the priests or something. It's really not. It's been the kings. It's been up to the kings to say, take down the high places. And they've only done it once that I can remember.
But even if the kings take down, they take them down one day, and the people start building them up. The priests start building them up the next day. It's the same way as when we talked about Elijah. He killed all the Baal priests, but by the time these kings came along, there were new priests of Baal. So they wipe out one generation, but another comes up.
So, and we're going to get into this more. So if you were thinking about this, how would you, let's say you're the king, King Charlene, how would you deal with the resurgence of the Baals, of the worship of the high places?
Well, the only way you do it is through heart change of the people.
So
you can't, it's just like in our government, you can't legislate laws that would destroy. It has to be heart change.
Mm-hmm. Well, you saw that during the time of Prohibition. You know, you can put a law on thou shalt not drink anymore, but the drinking wasn't the problem. It wasn't the drink that was the problem. It was the heart and the becoming obsessive with alcohol and letting alcohol control you. And it isn't the person who has a glass of alcohol with their, I mean, not alcohol, but like wine or something, or beer, yeah.
But it also, if you look back to Prohibition, it allowed certain people to become entrepreneurs and become wealthy from people's want of something that was not any longer legal.
So they used the high places. That alcohol for this country is a high place. It's not, like I said, it's not the drink, the one drink. It's the control it has. And some people have absolutely no, it would never bother them to have, they would never become a drunk or an alcoholic and could have a little glass of wine. I've been reading, I mean, you know this, but like in the time of Christ, the wine was really watered down because they had it for cleansing of the water they were drinking, so everybody drank wine, but it was wine that was very watered down. When they said at the Canaan feast that they brought the good wine out later, that was not watered down. And they usually don't do that they do it in the beginning, so everybody thinks they have great wine, and they get drunk and don't know, so...
But the wine was purer than the water because of the contamination, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. And it kills. I mean, if you were someplace and somebody had a bad accident and had a terrible open sore, you use alcohol, including wine, although wine wouldn't be as good as like whiskey or something like that, to clean out the sore because it's a purifier. So it's like I said, it's not that it's bad, it's how you use it that's bad. That's not true with false gods. False gods are all bad. So when we look in our lives, and I would like us to start thinking about this. We're done with our lessons next week, but I think that the lesson that we can learn through all of this is even the best have high places. And I think what we have a tendency of doing is protecting that little high place. You know, there may be nobody else in the whole world that knows that that's one of your high places. So I would like you to start a piece of paper. You don't have to put anything on it. Nobody else has to know about it. This is between you and God, where you start asking God to bring out your high places. So, because you can't deal with them if you don't really know that they're high places. I mean, as Americans, we always talk about materialism. Well, yeah. But I think that there are a lot. I mean, you could be obsessed and not come to church because you're going to baseball games. And that sounds not real big deal-ish, but for you, it might be. But I think there are all sorts. Bitterness, that's a high place to go back to. Wanting justice, when God has called you to forgive, is a high place. So just start paying attention and ask the Lord to show you your high places so that we can be free. Because when we think of this king that we're going to study today, spent his whole life looking like he served and loved the Lord, and Jehoiada dies, and it seems like 5.5 minutes later they're worshiping in the high places. Mm-hmm. Which lets you know it's like a big dam. The water is right there and everybody knows it's there, but they're not using it until the leak comes or something, and it's like that. As soon as it came, it just went rushing to the point that he killed Zechariah.
Yeah. Jehoiada was
we're going to go through it right now.
Yeah, I mean the Jehoiada's wife was Joash's sister. Is that right?
It was Athaliah's sister, Joash's aunt, because she saved him.
Okay, that's where I was. I knew there was a relative in there, Jehoiada was his uncle then.
Pardon?
Jehoiada was his uncle by marriage.
I guess if you want to call it that, yeah. I don't think they probably went that route. I don't know how they did their uncles and aunts things, because you have one king, and he has 7 or 8 wives. So how does that relate? How do those kids all relate? Well, not real well, because Athaliah killed all of them, so she didn't care about any of them.
Yeah, those were her grandchildren, too.
But they were, because they were her son's children. So she killed her grandchildren.
But we do know that Joash was the son of Ahaziah.
Yes.
Yes.
We don't know who the mother was.
We find out later.
Does it say Joash, the son of?
I'm trying to remember which
I
one.
I thought it did.
Surprised me. It
might be.
We'll see as we go through. But
yes, it does. Chapter 12.
Then I wonder what they do. Yeah,
the Rabiah of Beersheba.
Right. That's what I was trying to say. What was the first name?
Zabiah.
Yeah, I knew it was a Z. What happened to those women? What happened to the mother of all those kids? The mothers of those kids. Anyway, in 2 Kings 9, 21 through 28, what did you get out of that? What do you remember from that? It was about Jehoram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, and they went out together, each in his own chariot.
The property of Naboth.
Right.
The Jezreelite. Jehu carries out the word of the Lord for the murder of Naboth.
Fulfilled.
Yeah.
And Joram saw Jehu, and he said, "Is it peace?" Because he's wondering what Jehu's up to. Hmm. What did Jehu say?
"What's it to you?"
Join
me or die.
He says, "What peace? So long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many."
So
they were still doing their thing.
You know, it was kind of like your dad.
So, and then what did Jehu do?
Ooh. He killed all the house of Ahaz.
Actually Jehoram.
And he killed Azariah, because he was of the house of Ahab in his worship.
Well, he certainly was. He was related.
Yes.
Because his mother was the daughter of Ahab, mm-hmm. and the granddaughter of Omri.
Yeah.
So Jehu drew his full bull, his full strength, and he shot Joram first, because that's who he was sent to destroy. And the arrow went through his heart, and then he said, "Take him out and cast him into the property of the field of Naboth, the Jezreelite." Well, that he does work very much on a. I'm not sure I want to say justice system. A revenge. It's more of a revenge from Jehu's heart. The Lord said it would be said in an oracle against him. He was going to pay. Ahab would pay the price for that. But I think Jehu did it more as a. I think it was closer to murder myself, but that's another story. Said the Lord laid his oracle against Ahab. What did Ahab do?
He killed Naboth for the field.
For the field, because he wanted a garden.
Yeah.
So, and his sons.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Right.
So, and it is amazing. Whenever we take property is more valuable than people, we have a high place. And in this country, well, actually, it depends on what your heritage is. My heritage is very Scottish from my father's side, and land was very important because England came in and took all the land, and all the peasants actually lived on the land of barons and so on and so forth from England.
Is that when they were called serfs?
Right. And in the early 1900s, there were hordes of people that left because England's upper aristocracy came in and wanted the land back and didn't want them on the land. They wanted to use it for shooting.
Polo games.
Stuff like that, right. So they just threw all the people off the land that had been there whole generations. So when my father's family came over here, which wasn't much longer later than that, getting land was very, very important. And my father owned a lot of different land properties, and that was his high place, because that was more important than the family that he had. Time-wise, than everything you could think, and he used it as a weight. And so I watched with each one of us kids our different responses to that. My brother has accumulated land all over the world. He's got land in New Zealand he's going to go move to. I don't know how, since he can't even move, but that's his story. My sister's done it in a different way. She's done it collecting things, but they always take the place over people. And so, again, this is a family high place, and it's been passed on for generations. And you have yours. You have your family. It can be picking up a bitterness towards somebody who wronged you and carrying it several generations. It can be, I mean, it's there. So just pay attention. Because we can turn it over to the Lord. We can do that. We can cut the tie that binds. So, let's see. Did we get everything we need to there? Okay, let's go to 2 Chronicles 21. What did you learn there, beside the fact that Jehoaz is also Uzziah? Morning. So do you see?
You won't be late today. Had an errand around this morning.
So, Jehoram, son of Jehoshaphat, died in his evil to no one's regret.
That was very sad, and he was buried in the city of David, but not with the
tomb of the kings.
So he got punished for eternity. Why didn't they like him?
He was evil.
He walked in the way of the kings of Israel, in other words, Ahab and those.
And he had killed all his brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a very nice guy.
Yeah.
Got his place and made sure nobody else was going to take it. How did he die?
Terrible. Terrible.
We found that out from last week. Diane actually figured out what it was. But it was a terrible death.
Bowels turn inside out.
Yeah, and great pain, too.
They slide out, actually, is what they do. Mm-hmm. So, and it says, the Lord smote him in his bowels with an incurable illness. Can we cure it today?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually not a cure. It's a maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, cure means it's gone. And
they can
it's
repair it.
Right, yeah. But they can deal with it. They know how to deal with it today. Yeah. So it's still an incurable illness.
Yeah.
If you get it, it just doesn't have the same consequences. Okay, so up to 2 Kings 11. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Why did she do that?
She didn't want any competition.
She was about to try and take over.
Physical.
But Jehoshabah, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and placed him and his nurse in the bedroom. So they hid him from Athaliah, and he was not put to death. So, like you said, we found a very interesting, sweet little character here who actually is quite prominent in the sense of who she is, but not what she does. She does it quietly, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Behind the scenes. And she has what we call, she brought with her, which is kind of an amazing thing, but I guess he had one. She brought with him the nurse, the wet nurse. We call them wet nurses. They just call them nurses.
Today they're nannies.
Well, nannies don't nurse babies, but yeah.
Oh yeah, this was a...
This is a wet nurse. This is one who... So, I mean, I assume what that means is the princesses didn't nurse their babies? I have no idea. That's a story that isn't going to be answered. So who is this Athaliah?
The queen?
Well, The mother of Ahaziah.
She was the daughter of Ahab. Mother of Ahaziah.
And a grandmother, daughter of Omri.
Right. So, she set herself up as king, reigning over all the land for how long?
6 years.
Okay, that's kind of, you know, sometimes these dates they give us aren't particularly important, but this one kind of is. So she reigned for 6 years. In the 7th year, verse 4, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of hundreds of the Karaites. You know, did anybody look any of these up? Of the guard.
I tried to find the meaning of the Karaites, and all I could come up with they were the Cherethites or something like that.
There's definite places in the Old Testament that they're used. But what they are is part of the military order. So we have the first part, the captains of hundreds, And then they're part of, I guess, I'm guessing, those hundreds, and of the guard. But what is the purpose for doing all this? The captains of the hundreds, the Kerites, and the guards. What do they do?
Building an army.
He brought
for protection of the king, the future king.
And he does this at first by bringing them into the house, and he made a covenant with them. And he put them under an oath. So these men, hundreds, captains of hundreds, and the Kerites, and the guards, he made a covenant with them. What was the covenant?
Well, he shows them the king's son, first of all, that they weren't aware of, was
this
alive.
Was after 6 years.
Yeah.
So nobody knew about this.
Right.
When it could have gotten out and destroyed this child.
Yeah.
And they put him under an oath to do that, didn't they?
Yeah. To okay. not reveal the king's son to anybody.
Right. But evidently, Jehoiada knew it that whole time, too, because he was the husband. Then, verse 5, he commanded them, saying, this is the thing that you shall do. And so he starts to give them an elaborate, detailed proposition. What was it?
To guard the king.
And how did he set that up to happen?
He divided them by one-thirds.
Okay, so one-third of you, those guys.
And station them in different places.
Okay, I have a question.
Sure.
It says, you who come in on the Sabbath. That's the priests that do the duties of the temple.
Right.
Okay.
And they are to watch over the king's house. The king's house. It doesn't say God's house at
right.
this point.
Right.
Then one-third shall also be at the gate, sir, which is what? Why, what is that?
Is that the entrance to
the entrance to the temple.
Okay.
And then the third one is one-third at the gate behind the guards shall keep watch over the house for defense. Okay, and then in verse 7, two parts of you, even all who go out on the Sabbath, shall keep watch over the house of the Lord for the king. So they're watching two things. What are they watching?
The king's house and the temple.
Okay. And then, verse 8, you shall surround the king, each with his weapon in his hands. Can you imagine this little 7-year-old kid? And whoever comes within the ranks shall be put to death and be with the king when he goes out and when he comes in. So you have this king. And he is surrounded by men with weapons in their hands.
This little boy. This
little
7-year-old boy.
Little son who's never been out of a room.
And who probably has no idea he was king.
No.
No.
Although I'm sure he's being raised to be a godly man.
Right,
because
right.
he has Jehoiada and
right.
his wife there.
Yeah.
So so he's going to come out of oblivion into...
Yeah. So you wake up for breakfast one day and all of a sudden you're told, okay... We're going to have some strange people surrounding you.
And you are being protected. These are people
yes.
are protecting you.
Yes.
And they're going to be there when he goes out and when he comes in. So verse 9, so the captains of hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada, the priest, commanded. And each of them took his men who were to come in on the Sabbath with those who were to go out on the Sabbath. So, you know, you've got them coming in and going out.
Changing of the guard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's exactly right.
And,
yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and I like the part where he doesn't let the ones going out leave. They mm-hmm. stayed.
Mm-hmm. He came into Jehoiada the priest, and the priest gave to the captains of the hundreds the spears and the shields that had been King David's. Do you think this was symbolic at all?
Oh, yes.
What was it symbolic of? There's a lot of symbolism in the Bible. You have to be careful not to over-symbolize things. But what would this be symbolized? What do we know in the first part of what we've read of the covenant with David? What did it say?
There would be a king on the throne from Judah.
And so does it not seem like it fits that they are, it's King David's spears and shields mm-hmm. that were now in the hands of the captains of the hundreds, and they would be aware of that.
Yeah.
They would
and David had the king's guards, and I think that this is part of that, the pageantry that even we see in England today.
Right, right.
That they're part of the army, and yet they are the elite. And when Absalom took over Jerusalem and David had to flee, it was the king's guards that went with David.
Sort of like the smaller, more elite group. That are totally loyal, committed to
die. And they are to guard the king.
Right. To death. And they make that oath. We saw that they made an oath to that. So they are very trustworthy men. It's important because we're going to come to a very shocking end to that one.
One that's called armory had been in the house of the Lord, not in the palace.
No.
Had been in the house of the Lord.
So verse 11.
And just real quick, we had seen that before. I'm not going to turn to it, but whenever David and his men hid, whenever the priest, whenever the priest gave them the bread from the temple, and he brings out Goliath's sword, which wasn't like a kingly sword or anything, but it had been hidden in the house of the Lord. Mm-hmm. For some reason, that's where they kept things like that.
That would probably be the safest place, wouldn't it? I mean, the most protected place. The guards stood, each with his weapons in his hand, from the right side of the house to the left side of the house, by the altar, and by the house around the king. I just get this picture. This place is crowded with men. Mm-hmm. Verse 12, then he brought the king's son out and put the crown on him. Okay, so now we're watching
coronation.
He set up his king. Mm-hmm. He brought the king's son out. The king hasn't been around for 6 years. Mm-hmm. But we're kind of skipping over Athaliah here. Put the crown on him. Gave him the testimony. What's that mean?
Covenant, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's the words of God, what they had.
The fulfilling of David's son being on the descendants.
Right. And
right.
They made him king.
It's the
and
ark
they anointed
of the testimony.
Him. What do they do when they anoint somebody?
They pour oil.
They do. Yeah. I'm also picturing a dousing here, but I'm sure it isn't quite so. And they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king." And how old is he here?
Seven.
When Athaliah heard the noise of the guard, because where is she?
She's home and or in the palace. She's back in the palace.
And heard the noise of the guard and of the people. She came to the people. She came to the people. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. In the house of the Lord, she looked and behold, the king was standing by the pillar. So who's doing this? This little 7-year-old boy. Unless, of course, he was a Crandall, and then he was never little. The king was standing by the pillar, according to the custom, with the captains and the trumpeters beside the king. And all the people of the land rejoiced and blew trumpets. Not only was the king a little shocked with this new thing, but so was Athaliah. She walked in, and there's this room full of people also. She tore her clothes, and she cried, "Treason, treason." So what do we learn so far about Athaliah?
She was surprised.
Pardon? She was naked, other than that.
Well, at least she was in torn clothing. And she was holding on to her throne by saying that what you've done is treason.
Because she really looked at herself as the queen of all, but nobody ever gave her that position. There was no anointing.
She took it on herself.
She did.
Mm-hmm. She anointed herself with the blood of her children.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grandchildren, yes.
Comprehension.
We have several wipeouts here. We have one wipeout that wipes out all the sons, and then another wipeout that wipes out all the grandchildren. Jehoiada, the priest, commanded the captains of the hundreds who were appointed over the army and said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks, and whoever follows her, put to death." Why?
Because they're all, they all worship her.
Okay, they're Baal worshippers, and what might they do?
They might avenge her if they kill her without taking care of the followers.
So they not only are taking her out, but anybody who follows her will die with a sword. For the priest said, let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord. Why?
Taint this house. It would pollute the house of the Lord.
It would pollute
and
the house.
Isn't it also the house of God?
Mm-hmm. It's a house of peace.
She may not be called a priestess of Baal, but she is one. That's what she does. So they seized her, and when she arrived at the horse's entrance of the king's house, she was put to death there. Yes,
I find that
symbolism.
Scene, yes. She's where the horses go in. That's where they kill her.
All the horse stuff.
The dung is. And, yeah.
She just goes in with the rest of them. These women who put themselves in these positions die in pretty gross. Jezebel, mm-hmm. I mean,
that was
gross. Well, Athaliah got hers, too. You're going to see her die several times. But then Jehoiada made a covenant. Who did he make the covenant between?
The Lord, the king, and the people.
Why?
That
why?
We would be the Lord's people.
So that's
Baal.
That's the commitment. And so, again, he's trying to get the people to tear down the high places. And he knows, like we said earlier, that that doesn't mean they're not going to get put right back up. But they're put back up because they haven't been torn down in their hearts. Mm-hmm. And to get rid of, as was said earlier, to get rid of something like that, you actually have to change heart. You have to. If you keep living with it, it's just going to come back in your life again.
Well, and his responsibility to God wasn't to be responsible for the people's hearts that came after him. His responsibility was at that point in time, in that place, to do what the Lord told him to do.
Right.
And there's always choice in what the people choose to do after. If they build him up, it can be a great sorrow, but at least he knows that he did what God told him
to do. And he made, I think that's what's interesting about those covenants, which are different than like the Abrahamic covenant or the covenant of law, is you get a choice. You're either going to follow the covenant or you're going to follow Baal. You can't do both. And you have to make a commitment to it. Baal's not going to accept the worshiper of God who's following the covenant any more than God is going to accept the worshiper of the covenant who's following Baal. You don't get a choice. I mean, it's done when you make that decision. It's done, and that's why they make a big thing out of the covenants and the signing or the saying yes or the following. So, verse 18: all the people of the land went to the house of Baal. And what did they do?
Tore it down.
Well, not every single person did, but
they tore it down. And the altars, the images, they broke into pieces thoroughly. Those. And then they killed the priest Matan before the altars.
And so what did the priest do?
He appointed officers over the house of the Lord.
So again, you have this altar or this altar that you worship at. Verse 19, he took the captains of hundreds and the Karaites and the guards and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, and they came by the way of the gate of the guards to the king's house. And he sat on the throne of the kings. Who did?
Joash.
This little kid.
A little boy.
So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet. Why?
Because they had put Athaliah to death with a sword at the king's house.
Joash was 7 years old when he became king.
They probably didn't even give him a booster seat.
I didn't know what they were.
Maybe a short pillow.
I tried to imagine how the kind of the platform and the venue we can think of in Great Britain when those the pomp and circumstance. You know, all that goes on, and I'm trying to imagine all this happening within a 24-hour period, and all these people, hundreds and thousands and all the land. It's just kind of mind-boggling.
And they knew that this was going to happen, and they did it without Athaliah knowing. Mm-hmm. She just heard the noise, and she came to find out what the noise was all about.
We're talking about a grapevine of silence. I mean, they whispered it to
each other. I just, it's hard to wrap
it's mind-boggling how all that information got around to everybody.
Well, possibly even the captains went out before they went to take care of the king, and the ones who were off, not the ones who were on, maybe let the countryside know. Mm-hmm.
Because they all gathered. You think Athaliah would get? Well, she probably got. She probably got puffed up. They're coming to praise her.
But it's amazing that shows God's power. Mm-hmm. That no one challenged the prophet, the priest. Here.
That's
amazing. He really took on the role of king.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. And that's the consort.
And no one challenged that at all.
Mm-hmm. Nope. But they also didn't really give their hearts fully to it either.
No.
We can tell when he dies. And that's, again, another thing. We have to ask ourselves, what keeps me, meaning you and me, each one of us, what keeps me in the straight and narrow? What keeps me on the straight line? You know, if you're married, is it because your husband's following the Lord? Is it because you have to think about it, because those things can change. And when those things change, it tests what do we really believe? Who do we really follow? How much are we willing to let it cost us? And that's why I go back again. Keep paying attention to see where your high places are. You know, is your security because someone else gives it to you, or the church gives it to you? You can tell over the last few months how fast those things change. They just do, and they're going to keep changing. So, you know, I thought about that, like with big churches. I've watched big churches when the pastor goes, you end up losing like half the people sometimes, because they're following the person. They're not following the Lord first, or commitment to the people that they're part of. And so we need to pay that, because we're right in the middle of that kind of thing. So we need to pay attention to that. Why are we here? Are we here because of the walls, or are we here and we're going to change and leave because we don't like something?
Well, in this case, if the people chose to follow Pastor Ken, then they'd have to hang out on his front porch for a while.
Or in the garage.
The garage.
Oh, there's always a backyard.
Yeah.
I kind of experienced that after John's death.
Yeah.
I realized how much I kind of relied on him for a lot of things. And then when I was left without that, it's helped me to grow in my trust in the Lord. It really has.
And
I didn't even realize that before, really.
Well, it's because there's the legitimacy of relying on one another. Mm-hmm. There's the legitimacy of when I'm down and he's up, he can pull me out, and vice versa.
Right.
There is that legitimacy, but that's the legitimacy of the body of Christ.
Right.
So then I do have to realize that when I fall and he's not there, who am I going to rely on? And how do I rely on the Lord all by myself? And it becomes new. And that's why we never will in our lives, and I'm sure you've seen that many times, and we don't come to an end of the test. There's just always there. I wake up in the morning, and there's a surprising one I never knew about when I went to bed at night. And the test is always saying, do you love me?
Yes.
Or do you want your own way? What do I say to my kids? Do you love? I love you. And no, you can't have your own way. So God says to me, I love you. And you can't have your own way. And I'm going, why not? It's not that bad a way. I'm not talking about high places, ladies. High places. Verse 22. I haven't started. I guess I didn't start yet. Oh, yes, I did. So we learned about Athaliah. We've learned, and we need to ask ourselves, what is Athaliah's legacy? Because this is what we're doing. This is what our lesson is, in essence, about. So what is Athaliah's legacy?
They're glad she's gone. Mm-hmm. It's like, they don't care.
Where she's buried.
Yeah, they didn't bother saying where she was.
No, she's, as far as we know, she's with the horses. Yeah.
See, the people rejoice. That's your big clue.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there must have been a horrible 7 years.
Yeah.
And the city was at rest.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It was quiet.
Yeah, so there was turmoil prior to
she
that.
She was probably killing people.
Or fear. Can you imagine? I mean, just think of Hitler and Germany and other countries during World War II. And after he's dead, there are a large group of people who didn't know what to do with themselves because they had made him their god. Mm-hmm. But the rest of them, in the midst of buildings being destroyed and the world totally having fallen apart around them, it was quiet. And they didn't have to fear him coming after them. We don't think about things like that because we've never been in that place where we've been that. Well, I can't say we've never. I don't know if your generation, when they went through World War II, was there fear there?
Oh, I'm sure that there was fear. I can remember they were afraid of Japanese subs out in Puget Sound. And, the fear of, that's when they incarcerated all the Japanese people.
Yep, right.
That was out of fear.
Yeah. Didn't you guys have towers here? Look out.
Oh, yeah.
The spotters.
We had observers of airplanes. We did that. We observed airplanes going over even Granite Falls because we were in line with Seattle for air path.
And I think that's when they built up Jim Creek, too.
Yeah.
There were silos at Jim Creek.
Yeah. And up at Big Four.
That's the radio station.
A little bit above Arlington.
Yeah, the lookout.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was.
Well, and it's still there, and it's still
functioning with subs. Yeah.
Secret.
So, Christians, in the middle of all that, can we be at peace?
Yes.
I mean, we say we can, but can we? And if we can't, we have to think about those high places that we've got. Yeah. If we are independent, it's very, very difficult to be at peace when you're the one who has to be in control of making the peace.
Well,
and probably one of the things that was more disturbing for the people was rationing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get coffee. That. They couldn't get sugar, rubber.
Americans don't put up with that.
And that was hard on people.
Yeah. And I've got the rationing tickets from my dad's gas rationing. Yeah.
Oh. Well, in the Christians, Japanese people, who were Christians at that time were put in the internment camps too. Yeah. We have a book that a friend of the family who was put in there, and her mom was a strong Christian, and just how she taught the children through the whole time that the land was taken, everything was taken, and just how she taught her children and the legacy that mom left to her children of, you know, someday this is all going to be over. How do we want to remember how we acted during this time?
And how we're going to treat the people who have treated us poorly.
Yes.
Because there again, if you're a person who's justice-oriented, even if you're justice-oriented for other people, there's a point where you're going to have to realize this is a high place. Mm-hmm. I have to leave justice to God.
Yeah.
And I need to learn to forgive and love, and I have no clue how to do that.
Yeah,
and
they were people who were sending their sons off to fight in the war for freedom while they were still incarcerated.
Right. And they called them Nissan troops, many of those young men died in Okinawa.
Well, I'm sure they put them first in the line.
Yeah.
They did it with Germans, too, in a different way.
As with the Civil War, they put the black people.
Right.
Years in front. Yeah.
Cut down the line. So, let's see. Now, this brings out a little different picture. It says, Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king. And he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri.
Where are you at?
Chronicles 22, after 21. Sorry.
Well, he was the one that visited Joram of Israel, and he was caught by Jehu.
He was.
In that visit, and that's why he didn't live very long.
He just had a 1-year stint, and he was only 22.
And he was, yeah, he was only 23 when he was killed.
He said, it says he walked in the way to the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor. What is a counselor? What do you counsel
advisor?
To do wickedly?
Hmm? Sort of like an advisor.
It is. What does that mean?
She taught him advice on what he should and shouldn't do, and sort of like a mother telling him, you do this or you do that.
And she taught him to do what?
And his mother encouraged him to
the house of Baal.
Wickedly.
Wickedly.
Yes.
And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, like the house of Ahab, for they were his counselors. Who was his counselors?
The house of Ahab
was his counselors.
Yeah,
and after the death, they were his counselors, after the death of his father, and to his destruction. So he walked according to their counsel. And what do you think the counsel would be in the house of Ahab with his mother as a counselor to do wickedness? What were the... what areas is
worship
talking about?
The Baal and to follow the Asherim and all those other idols that they had.
So even though that was up north, because Baal worship was
that
brought
was
in up in Israel,
yeah.
It is now being drenched and dribbled and drained down to the south, to Judah. And how did that happen?
Yeah. Through marriage.
Uh-huh. Through marriage. Through marriage to somebody from the north, Ahab's daughter.
Yeah, whom God said, don't mingle.
And by that time, it isn't even the mingling of the Gentile world. It's with those who call themselves
Jews. With idol worshippers.
They're still idol worshippers, aren't
but
they?
But they're part of Israel.
They are.
God's
it says Ahab, king of Israel. He also counseled, according to their counsel, they went to Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, to wage war against Hazael, king of Aram, at Ramoth-Gilead. But what happened?
There.
Joram was wounded.
Arameans wounded, yeah.
Jehu overtook them all.
So what's the problem here? Let's mush through this. It says, when Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, went to wage war, did he bother to pray?
No.
Did he even walk with the priests of the Most High God?
Doesn't even mention it.
Because we know he's got counsel to follow Baal. Mm-hmm. So he's going out with Baal as his flag, and the Arameans wounded him. Surprise, surprise. Because he keeps forgetting God. They seem, king after king, person after person, seem to forget that God's in charge. You go to him, you see what he wants, not what you decide, and ask him to bless it or someone else. So he returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which they had inflicted on him at Ramah when he fought against Hazael, king of Aram. And Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to see Jehoram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel, because he was sick. So what was the outcome of that?
Kind of got killed.
Yeah, we talked that. That was what we talked earlier about Jehu. What? How was Jehu brought on the scene? How do we meet him in verse 7? In this section.
Oh, okay. Well,
in Chronicles.
He came out. Okay. The destruction of Ahaziah was from God, in that he went to Joram. For when he came, he went out with Jehoram against Jehu, the son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to cut off the house of Ahab. Yeah.
So Jehu knew he was anointed.
It came when Jehu.
Ahaziah and Jehoram did not know they were, because they weren't. So Jehu, and we see he was rather, I don't know if the word was bloodthirsty, but kind of cold. He goes and kills and then has dinner.
But God used him.
He did.
Yeah.
That's another thing I want to pay attention to. I'm going to read a story at the very end that's a true story. Because I think Jehu in our set principles is a little confusing.
Well, especially when you look at verse 8. I think Jehu went beyond what God had ordered him. Well, maybe not. It came about Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab. He found the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers ministering, and he killed them too.
Yeah, okay, but there
are two questions there. Do we hear God correct that?
No.
Do we? What would they have done had they not been slain?
Killed him.
Probably.
Or others.
Oh.
They were of the house of Ahab too.
Yes.
I think that was something.
Yes.
I've forgotten until you guys reminded me earlier.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he said when he prophesied that the house of Ahab would be totally, except somehow Joash got through.
Well, he wasn't of Ahab's house. He was in southern in Judah.
Well, no, but he was Ahaziah's son.
Yes.
And Ahaziah was family.
From the house of Ahab.
He was a confusion.
He was a confused 7-year-old that easily flipped out when Jehoiada passed.
So Jehu, well, it does say in verse 8, Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab, and that includes more than just Ahab. It's the princes of, and the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers ministry to Ahaziah, and he slew them. What were they doing there?
Taking care of Ahaziah.
Well, and was Ahaziah sick? What was Ahaziah doing there?
He came to see Joram, his relative, however it was related.
And what kind of a king was Ahaziah? What did he follow?
Baal.
He followed the ways of Baal. So he really was of the house of Ahab, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And again, when God says in... with the kings, either they follow the way of Ahab or they follow the way of Jeroboam. There is something specifically that's being said about that. One is that they are following the ways of Baal, and the other is that they're following the ways of the divided calf, which is idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on Judaism, but it goes its own way. And God is not in it, and God did not set it up. So can we do the same kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Well, and not only that, too, but remembering back to Exodus and whenever God executed judgment on the things of Egypt, the scripture tells us in a verse that it was against the demons that were behind those gods. And so whenever we think about Baal, and maybe somebody will go, what's the big deal? It was this stone statue up on this hill. Yeah, and the big deal is the demons that are behind that. And
satanic.
Yes, and we don't necessarily see that, but God sees it, and God knows. And if you get deep enough into that, then you see it, but by then it's too late to come out of it.
It's a system that's not God's. It's not
right,
how God's
right.
set up for worship.
Right.
It's not worship.
But it's not
God
just exactly. But it's not just play on words here. But it's not
right.
just an idle thing.
It's not a dead.
It's not an IDLE thing. It's a real IDOL with demons behind it.
It's a continuation of the war in heaven.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And we know that any God that is not the one true God.
Yes.
Is that.
Yes.
Exactly. And it is there to get us to turn away from the God of heaven. And they are also, I was looking at the Book of Mormon yesterday, and it said on it, I'm not going to say this right exactly, but it said the Book of Mormon, another testament about Jesus. And I'm thinking, yes, it is.
Exactly.
It's not a correct estimate about Jesus. It's another one, and they were meaning like this is the fourth one, or the, you know, the fall. Mm-hmm. This is the other gospel, or this is the, you know, whatever they mean. But what they're saying is they're not the one true testament of Jesus.
And Paul said, any other testament is cursed.
That's right. It's not what they've taught us, and keep our little buggery hands off it. You know what I think is interesting? Well, I was just thinking this when I was looking at the Book of Mormon, thinking, did it ever occur to you people that this is like third grade English, and God never wrote in English? It came about for us, the executing judgment after I fought to death. Verse 9. We have the Sluim in verse 8. And he sought Ahaziah, and they caught him while he was hiding in Samaria. Boy, is that appropriate.
Wrong place.
They brought him to Jehu. They brought him to Jehu. They put him to death, and they buried him. For they said, he is the son of Jehoshaphat, who sought the Lord with all his heart. So there was no one in the house of Ahaziah to retain the power of the kingdom. Verse 10. So we've got Athaliah again. I mean, we're going through several different chapters that have the stories in it.
I have a question.
Sure.
If Jehoshaphat was Ahaziah's father.
Well, he really wasn't. He was his. Oh, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
And then Athaliah is his mother.
Yes.
So, is
Jehoshaphat the father or the grandfather?
That's what I'm trying to some people.
Right, sometimes it intermingles those.
Right. Jehoshaphat, but it would have been the grandfather.
It was Jehoshaphat, then Joram, and then Ahaziah.
Okay.
Right?
From the south.
Yeah, and Judah. In Judah.
That's what was confusing, Grace, because we also have him tied into the north, which Athaliah was
the north.
The daughter of, and then the queen of, and so on and so forth.
Well, there was Ahaziah of Israel, too. He came after Ahab.
Right.
Yeah, but I was thinking, I was just going through verse 9 and trying to get it into my head.
Don't you remember, I mean, vaguely, because we get so many names, I begin to forget all the stories, but don't you remember it was Jehoshaphat who was a good king and all of his kids rebelled? All of them?
That's sad.
Beyond sad. Okay.
So, in that story of all of them going bad, I wonder who the main influence was.
Well, we have Omri and Ahab coming up.
Is Omri?
Oh, he was wicked too.
But was he?
But his, what I'm saying is,
Jehoshaphat, or
son,
who's his father?
Omri was the father of Ahab.
Right.
Oh, okay, all right.
So that when the mixture of the marriage came together, both of those families came together.
Yeah.
Now when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Okay, did we learn anything else here about Jehoshaphat?
They spell her name different here.
Yeah, that's the one that confused me.
Yeah.
Because I saw Jehoshaphat in that name.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yes. Did you learn anything new about her?
She was a king's
daughter. She was married to.
And she took Joash, son of Athaliah. Mm-hmm.
And she was wife of Jehoiada the priest.
Right.
And she was a sister of Ahaziah. Who knows how, but she was.
Right. Whether it's half-sister or full-sister, we don't know.
And, of course, she hid the little one from Athaliah, so that's...
So far, pretty much the same story.
Yeah.
Take out the A and she's Jehoshaphat.
Yeah, that's the story.
Is she related?
To?
She is Jehoshaphat.
So would she be a granddaughter of Jehoshaphat?
So we know who she followed.
Yes, and her brother did not. And that, again, that's what we go. I think it's very odd that Joash, as we are beginning to see, Joash influence in his life was only godly.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. And yet
didn't have Athaliah, didn't have Ahab, didn't even have Azariah, his father. Mm-hmm. all the bad counsel is gone. It's not there. He was not raised in that. And that's why we see him making good decisions, and he said he was good and he followed the Lord until...
until the priest died.
Until the priest died. Okay, so I mean, just looking at that, you can see personal choice. When you see that she, the sister of Athaliah, made godly, righteous choices that could have cost her life, and Athaliah followed the way of mommy and the counsel of mommy.
Well, in Jehoshaphat, was such a godly woman that the priest married her. I mean, that's really a big deal.
Yeah, I'm sure they looked very carefully, because a man in the position of being a leader of people in spiritual things cannot do it without a wife that's there too.
Right.
It just can't.
Yeah.
She might have been very, very young when she was married, you would think. Because she probably heard the Baal worship when she was a tiny child.
But she heard both.
But she heard both, and she chose the right.
Right.
And even so, that he would go into that family and see and choose the one.
But we also know that God planted her there.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Right.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the amazing thing of the Lord. He takes... That's why we can say he makes... all things good come out of all things to those who love God and are called according to his purposes.
All things work for the good.
They do. Yeah. If they love God and are called according to his purposes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so then we have a list. Oh, we're in 2 Chronicles 23 now. In the seventh year, Jehoiada strengthened himself and took up. Now we see this, though. Seventh year should be a click to us. What's going on in the seventh year? Seventh year of who?
Joash.
He took the captains of hundreds, and here we get another confusion. Azariah, the son of Joram, which has nothing to do with the kings, and Ishmael, who has nothing to do with the past, the son of Joan, you got that whole list. Okay, so... And they entered into a covenant with him. Who entered into a covenant with who?
All of these
captains of the hundreds with Jehoiada.
Okay. And they went throughout Judea, and they gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the heads of the father's house. Now, what is this adding to the story as we've known it so far?
And the heads of the father's households of Israel.
We didn't get it quite so personal. That also answers the question, how did that information get out? That Joash was about to get crowned
through the priests
as they went out. The heads of the father's house of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem. Then all the assembly made a covenant with the king. What king are they talking about?
Well, it's little Joash.
But
who's now?
They really made the covenant with Jehoiada.
Yeah.
And the covenant was what they were going to do for Joash.
Right. And he's now about 14, evidently. Because it says in the seventh year, Jehoiada strengthened himself.
That's in the seventh year of Jehoiada.
Oh, okay.
Because Joash was only seven.
Right. But I didn't know if... Okay, you're right. Yeah, I was adding this seventh year onto the one we learned back in Kings, but no, never mind.
Yeah, well, we know because we're back to the original covenant, so
true,
that's the way we can tie it all together. And with
this is the seventh year that after they hit.
Right.
Yeah. So,
Jehoiada must have come in to the priesthood just about the same time as Athaliah killed all the. It's the seventh year of Jehoiada. So,
well, it's actually in the seventh year, Jehoiada strengthened himself.
Right. So,
I think
it's after, in looking back in 22, it's after they started hiding him.
It's the seventh year because they've got everything
set up.
If we think about it, they based everything around the covenant, the promise that was made to David.
Yeah.
And because a promise was made to David that one from his line would be on the throne, they've been waiting for this child to grow up.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that's, when we say the seventh year, it's now the seventh year Jehoiada is about to do what he's been called
yes.
to do.
Right, because back in verse 12, it was 6 years.
Yeah,
hidden
right.
in the house of God, 6 years.
Right.
Yeah.
So they went through, and we saw that verse 3. Got so much writing on here, I can't even see under it. Then all the assembly made a covenant with the king in the house of God, and Jehoiada said to them, behold, the king's son. Now, who's the king that he's talking about?
Ahaziah.
Pardon?
Ahaziah, the king's mm-hmm. son?
Yes.
Is Joash, and he's the son of Ahaziah.
Even though he's
Ahaziah.
Long gone.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many A-H's and A-Z's and A... Who knows? Behold, the son, king's son shall reign as the Lord has said, spoken concerning the sons of David. So again, we're taken back to remember the promise that God made to David. This is the thing which you shall do. One third of you, and then go through that. One third of you, the priests and the Levites who come on the Sabbath, shall be the gatekeepers. One third shall be at the king's house, and a third at the gate of the foundation. And all the people. It didn't say number 4. They're all separate. All the people shall be in the courts in the house of the Lord. So we have this link. What is the link between man and God here?
The covenant.
The covenant.
Yes.
They're all turning their commitment, their loyalty, their statements of faith towards God. And God has called the protection of the son of David. Any questions or statements on that? Verse 6, but let no one enter the house of the Lord except the priests and the ministering Levites, because that's the Sabbath thing, that they may enter, for they are holy. And let the people keep the charge of the Lord. What is the charge of the Lord?
To keep their covenant.
To protect the little one.
So, the charge also has the connotation of keeping the obedience to. So, they're keeping the obedience to the covenant that they made, the promise they made, the loyalty that they've made to the child, to his position, because of David and the promise God made to David. All of that keeps coming back in. Verse 7, the Levites will surround the king, each man with his weapon in his hand, and whoever enters the house, let him be killed. Why?
Because they're protecting the little one, and there might be a little sneaky person come in and want to kill him.
And the Levites can enter because they are what?
They're holy.
They are holy. So if this person is entering the house of the Lord, who's not a Levite, needs to be killed because he is not holy and he is not committed to the protection of the king when he comes in and when he goes out. In verse 8, so the Levites and all Judah did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded, and each of them took his men who were to come on the Sabbath with those who were to go out on the Sabbath. For Jehoiada, the priest, did not dismiss any of the divisions. So it's an ingathering, and everybody's there, so all the protectors are, it's doubled. It kind of needs to be. Then Jehoiada, the priest, gave to the captains of hundreds and the spears and the large and small shields, which had been King David's and which were in the house of God. He stationed all the people. What does stationing all the people mean?
Putting them on guard, mm-hmm. duty.
In specific right. places, they took their stand.
Mm-hmm.
Each man with his weapon in his hand, from the right side of the house to the left side of the house, by the altar and by the house around the king. So, what is the point of all these people?
Guarding the king.
Guarding the king around the king. Verse 11. Then they brought out the king's son and put the crown on him, and gave him the testimony, and made him king, and Jehoiada and his sons anointed him, and said, long live the king. Okay, at this point, you've got that introduction with Jehoiada and his sons. Mm-hmm. So where were the sons, and who are the sons and Jehoiada in relationship to the king, to the child? To Joash, who are these men?
Well, the wife of him is sister to King Uzziah.
Cousins.
Jehoiada is her husband, Joashabiah. And so their children would be through the line of Jehoashabiah.
The woman, Jehoiada's wife.
So wouldn't the relation come through her?
So who are these people? Who have these people been? Just in his life, when he goes to breakfast in the morning, who are these people to him?
He grew up
servants. They're servants.
Well, not yet.
And protectors.
But they are going to be.
But he grew up with
family.
These people.
Family.
They are like family. In fact, it calls Jehoiada the father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We think of, I mean, what father did he have in his life was Jehoiada.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Who were his brothers and sisters? Jehoiada's children. Because he was hiding in the room.
Room in the temple.
In the temple. And that's all he knew. And that's why how he ends his life is so hard to look at. Yeah, Grace.
The statement is Jehoiada and his sons. So that's Jehoiada's sons.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Would that
still,
son be there?
Seven.
It's not named. Could that have been Zechariah?
Well, probably.
Well, it says sons, but yes. I assume that that's all there. Now, this is still, again, Athaliah has been no, she hasn't been resurrected, but she's back again. When Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she came into the house of the... Now, that's a little different. How is it different, how they said it here?
She came into the house.
And it says that they were running and praising the king. She came
she
into
said
the house.
She came into the house of the Lord. Yeah. So that's...
Well, she couldn't come in, but they weren't going to kill her there. They pushed her back out.
Right. She came into the house of the Lord to the people. She didn't come to the other people. She just came to the people. She looked, and behold, the king was standing by the pillar at the entrance. We've gone through this before. Anything new here?
The singers and their musical instruments leading the praise. And the people blew trumpets.
So they had trumpeters who blew their trumpets. This kind of makes sense.
And they had singers and their instruments, which wasn't mentioned before.
The trumpeters were mentioned, but not the singers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Then Athaliah tore her clothes and said treason, treason. And Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains of hundreds who were appointed over the army and said to them, bring her out between the ranks, and whoever follows her put to death with a sword. Have we ever seen a priest do this before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who have we seen do this before?
Oh, way back. It started whenever in the book of Exodus, I mean, whenever God is anointed, Phinehas was it, who put to death everybody who was worshiping the golden calf.
And we saw it with Elijah and Elisha, didn't we?
Yes, yes.
For the priest said, let not her be put to death in the house of the Lord. And they seized her, and when she arrived at the entrance of the horse gate of the king, he put her to death there. And then I feel like I'm reading the same chapter all over again.
Mm-hmm. Well, one is Israel's rendition, and one is Judah's, right?
Well, and actually, God's from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. When I went to Bible college, what they said to us, and I can't really know that fully, but Kings is from man's perspective and Chronicles is supposed to be from God's perspective.
So, but
a lot of times they just merge and are exactly the same perspective, and other times they seem a little bit different.
Sometimes a little bit more detail at times.
Yeah. Then Jehoiada made a covenant between himself and all the people and the king that they would be the Lord's people. That's so they're all committing themselves to that. It's not even the commitment of protecting the child. It's that they would be the Lord's people. And what does the Lord call them to do? To protect the child.
They've done that before, too.
Right, yeah. And all the people went to the house of Baal and tore it down and broke it in pieces his altars and his images and killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. Okay. Anything? Did we see anything new there besides the singers? Pretty close rendition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Verse 18, moreover, Jehoiada placed the offices of the house of the Lord under the authority. Now, this is different.
Mm-hmm.
Under the authority of the Levitical priests whom David had assigned over the house of the Lord. So those who are already over the house of the Lord, he gave an authority to them. And he placed the offices of the house of the Lord under them. And what did they do over the house of the Lord?
They offer burnt offerings.
As it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and singing according to the order of David. Notice how those two things got tied together.
Mm-hmm.
He stationed the gatekeepers of the house of the Lord so that no one would enter who was in any way unclean. He took the captains of hundreds, nobles, the rulers of the people, and all the people of the land, and brought the king down from the house of the Lord and came through the upper gate to the king's house. Then they placed the king upon the royal throne. So all of the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet, for they had put Athaliah to death with the sword. Again, just almost the same thing. 2 Kings 12, in the seventh year of Jehoash became king, and he reigned for 40 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Zebiah of Beersheba.
Do we learn any more about this?
Joash did right in the sight of the Lord all his days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him.
There's your clue right there.
And that's a beautiful statement. If it just kept going, it would be even more so. Only the high places were not taken down. And again, as long as those high places stay up, it's really easy in difficult times to go back to them.
Mm-hmm. And the people still sacrificed and burned incense
on the high places.
So they never gave it up.
Nope. They sort of tied the two together.
So much.
But Jehoiada is going to die. Then Joash said to the priests, all the money of the sacred things which is brought into the house of the Lord in current money, both the money of each man's assessment and all the money which a man's heart prompts him to bring to the house of the Lord. What does that mean?
Free will offerings and offerings that were designated by Moses in the Old Testament.
Let the priests take it for themselves. Take what for themselves?
The offering.
Is that part of the Old Testament?
Yes, because they had no land of their own.
That's right. The Levitical priests
had no way of gaining money except through the duties of the what did they call it? The not the tithes, but the
atonement.
10% anyway.
They call it the tribute, but there was a term used. Levies or something.
There are levies in there. And also.
And fees. And
but
there's something that.
To look at.
Yeah. What's that word?
Yeah.
So the priest took only the money.
We
like Moses had said to the congregation, just. The offerings of whatever that levy was. They didn't take all the free will offerings. They just took the, from what I'm reading in this.
They took the, from my understanding, they took the atonement. But I wrote some of these verses down, but I'm not sure which ones they were.
I
think you want to look up Exodus 34:13.
Because it says the money of each man's assessment. Maybe that was what the money that Moses had said each man gets.
It was by his possession.
Exodus 34:13.
Yeah.
It says, but rather you were to tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and cut down their asherim.
Yeah. That was not it. Well, maybe it will come into it as we continue reading. There is a section where it tells, basically, the money that the priests were to get was to come from the sacrifices and atonements they made. Not all the money that came in, but for specific things. And here, Joash has got, he calls it money of the sacred things, which is brought into the house of the Lord in current money. So this is what a man believes he is to bring. This is not set aside to go to the priests. What is to go to the priests is exactly what you were saying earlier, Sherilyn, that where they earned their living was taking the offerings and the sacrifices and the Day of Atonement, the atonements for the sins, which is what they were, and those were not supposed to go into the coffers. Not just because the priest needed to be taken care of, but because in a way it was not dirty money, but it wasn't from the heart for the purpose
sin.
Of giving
it
to
was,
for
yeah.
sin, exactly.
Yeah.
So they kept those, they were to keep those monies separate.
And they were different than the peace and goodwill offered.
Right, exactly. Which came from a man's heart. So then, but it came about that in the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had not repaired the damages of the house. Now just think about this for a minute. Is it the priests that are supposed to do that?
The people.
It should be the people. And it actually is a job that is hired out. So the king called for Jehoiada the priest, for the other priests, and said, "Why do you not repair the damages of the house? Now, therefore, take no more money from your acquaintances," which is, that's the picture of the levy, "but pay it for the damages of the house." So the priests agreed that they would take no more money from the people, nor repair the damages of the house. Did it sound like they agreed to the same thing? Does 8 agree with 7?
No.
No, it doesn't, because they're not going to pay for the damages of the house.
Right.
But Jehoiada the priest took, I think he's a very wise man, took a chest and bore a hole in the lid and put it beside the altar. In this chapter he does. On the right side, as one comes into the house of the Lord, and the priests who guard the threshold put all the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. When they saw that there was much money in the chest. Now, what is this chest thing?
Sort of like an offering box.
Sort of like an offering box, which is from the heart stuff, which the king's scribe and the high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord. They gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work. Now this is what the money is to go for, to fix the...
To hire the workmen for the repair.
And he's worthy of his hire. The hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord, and they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, to the masons and the stonecutters, and for buying timber and hewn stone to repair the damages to the house of the Lord for all that was laid out for the house to repair. Now, who did not do this?
The priests did not do that work.
The priests did not do that. This was not what they were supposed to do.
They were like overseers, weren't they?
Well, they were spiritual overseers.
But the Levites were to do the maintenance of the... that was the difference between the priests and the Levites. In Exodus, the priests were to do the work of the Lord, and the Levites were to maintain to carry the
worship system.
Yes. Yeah. But it kind of shows you that the temple of God was in disrepair because all the attention had been on the temple of Baal.
Right.
And they had stolen the instruments of the Lord and put them into the, and used them in the worship of Baal.
And they're not going to bring them back because that's the, it's degraded. It's idolatry.
So that's why they had to be destroyed.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, in this chapter, which is in Kings versus the chapter in Chronicles, we have something added in Chronicles. Verse 13 here said, but they were not made for the house of the Lord, silver cups, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, or any of the vessels of gold or vessels of silver from the money which was brought to the house of the Lord. For they gave it back to those who did the work. With it, they repaired the house of the Lord. But what's added when you get to Second Chronicles?
They made utensils.
With the money that was left over. Mm-hmm. So they first built the temple, rebuilt the temple and fixed it, but they did use the money that was left over for the needed utensils.
There's a word I was looking for in verse 9 of 24. Levy fixed by Moses.
Levy, yeah.
Oh, when you're going to Chronicles, yes. And that, and that's the same as...
And then, yeah,
fees or tribute or whatever, yeah. Levy.
Verse 15, moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men to whose hand they gave the money to pay to those who did the work, for they dealt faithfully. That is a really honorable thing to have been said about them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if we go to Chronicles, we also get that those men took the leftover money and didn't hold on to it for themselves, but gave it back to the temple for the silver cups and the snuffers and the bowls and the trumpets and etc. So all the stuff that was needed for the temple, they just gave back.
Kind of sounds like when they built the tabernacle and the people gave so much they had to tell them to stop.
Stop.
Giving.
They had,
it shows their hearts were turned toward the Lord at that time.
I don't remember the spot, but the reason they wanted to replace the utensils was because they had been misused by
what's her name.
They had been taken to the worship of Baal.
Yeah,
exactly.
So they weren't clean anymore.
No, they weren't. No longer holy, no longer set apart. Verse 16, the money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought to the house of the Lord, for it was for the priests. And that's where we've got our verse that tells us how the priests are provided for, the guilt offering. And we're certainly always going to have plenty of guilt and sin. So priests are probably doing just fine, thank you. Verse 17, Mahaziel, king of Aram, went up and fought against Gath and captured it, and Mahaziel set his face to go to Jerusalem. Have we seen him in Jerusalem before?
Yes.
Mahaziel?
Let's see. Oh. The cross reference is the same story at the same time.
Okay.
So,
so we really haven't seen him head down towards Jerusalem. Yeah.
But that's
really
why
seen him too.
The only time is when Elisha wept because he knew what Hazael was going to do.
Yeah. But he was a prophet to who? Who was Elisha a prophet to?
Israel.
To the north, right.
Yes.
So, in the south, he hasn't really put his head towards the south yet.
Right.
Okay, Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his father's, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold that was found among the treasures of the house of the Lord, and of the king's house, and sent them to Ahaziel, king of Aram. Now, all of a sudden, we get this bounce here.
Yeah.
What was this all about? What just happened here?
He just bought him off.
Yeah.
So what did he put his trust in?
Material.
And money and so if it's somebody else comes along, is he going to have any money to pay them off with?
No.
It's his first challenge, evidently, and he was afraid.
And he didn't go to the Lord. And that's what we have to keep looking at.
This is after Jehoiada's death, correct?
Probably, but it doesn't say.
It doesn't say.
Not yet, it doesn't say that.
That's in Chronicles.
Now, and it goes in verse 19, though, the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles, so on and so forth? His servants, this is an interesting statement just put there. His servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash at the house of Milo as he was going down to Silla. For, and I have no idea how I say that, Jozachar, the son of Shimeth, and one of those guys, his servants.
I like that name.
Struck him, and he died. So, how did Joash die?
By his own servants.
By his own servants. Weren't these guys committed to, what were they committed to? What did they have a covenant for? What did it say?
They were to protect him.
And to keep the charge of the Lord.
To keep the charge
of him. That's what they're doing. Possibly here, this is the charge of the Lord. Mm-hmm. His servants struck him and he died. And they buried him with his fathers in the city of David. And Amaziah, his son, became king in his place. Amaziah, yes. That's a very interesting little parenthesis.
In Chronicles, it's different, isn't it? Joash?
Well, let's find out.
Okay.
Joash was 7 years old, verse 1, Chronicles 24, when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah, so we've got her again. Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest, and Jehoiada took two wives for him, and he became the father of sons and daughters. Now it came about after this that Joash decided to restore the house of the Lord. Okay, so we have the same story. Was there anything added here?
We shall do the matter quickly.
Here it is, Exodus 30, 12 through 16. Somebody want to look up Exodus 30? Because it says here, why have you not required the Levites to bring in from Judah and from Jerusalem the levy, as Grace said earlier, fixed by Moses, the servant of the Lord, on the congregation of Israel for the tent of testimony? What is the atonement? Exodus 30, 12 through 16. Somebody want to read that?
I have it.
Okay.
Exodus 30, 12 through what?
16.
I haven't had it in my mouth today. Maybe. Do you want me to let somebody else?
Go attempt.
Okay. Whenever you take a census of the people of Israel, it says, each man who is counted must pay a ransom for himself to the Lord.
Which, that's his assessment, guys. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
Then no plague will strike the people as you count them. Each person who is counted must give a small piece of silver as a sacred offering to the Lord. His payment is half a shekel, based on the sanctuary shekel, which equals 20 gerahs. All who have reached their 20th birthday must give this sacred offering to the Lord. When this offering is given to the Lord to purify your lives, making you right with him, the rich must not give more than the specified amount, and the poor must not give less. Receive this ransom money from the Israelites, and use it for the care of the tabernacle. It will bring the Israelites to the Lord's attention, and it will purify your lives.
So, what was that money for?
For the Levite
care.
Israelites.
Yeah. It says, but what was it for?
It was a sin offering.
Atonement money.
Atonement money. There was a different word that was used there. What was the word that your version read? It is atonement money, but it's the same
ransom.
Word. Ransom. Okay. That's good. I like that. Yeah. That it says that. Yeah. So they're paying the ransom or the atonement money, which is, this is the levy that's fixed by Moses. Okay?
Right.
So if you want to read up on it, you can read Exodus. So the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things in the house of God for the Baals. And that's where we learned that. We didn't really learn that in Kings. Verse 8, the king commanded, and they made a chest and set it out by the gate of the house of the Lord. So is this something that the king is supposed to do? Is this his area?
No.
I think it's the priest area.
It's the priest area. So the king commanded it, they made a chest, and they set it out. Now, where did Jehoiada put the chest?
Outside.
Put it by the altar. They put it outside. The king had them put it outside. Jehoiada did not do that. They made a proclamation in Judah and Jerusalem to bring the Lord the levy fixed by Moses, the servant of God, in Israel, the wilderness. All the officers and the people rejoiced. They brought their levies. They dropped them into the chest until they had finished. And it came about whenever the chest was brought to the king's officers by the Levites, and when they saw there was much money, then the king's scribes and the chief priest officers would come and empty the chest and take it and return it to its place. Thus they did daily and collected money. The king and Jehoiada gave it to those who did the work, and we've got that list. I'm not going to go through that whole list again. I'm trying to finish on time. Verse 14, when they finished, they bought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada and made the utensils. This is where we see that. When they finished and they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, it was made into utensils for the house of the Lord, which, by the way, are about to be given away. Utensils for the service and the burnt offerings and the pan, utensils of gold and silver. They offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada. Now when Jehoiada reached a ripe old age, he died. He was 130 years at his death. That's amazing. They buried him in the city of David, and to add to that honor, among the kings. That's a great honor because he had done well in Israel. And by the way, did you notice they called it Israel? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What just happened there?
It's united.
They were united them. Because he had done well in Israel. Where was Jehoiada? He was in Judah. Mm-hmm. So to say that he had done well in Israel just pulled them together mm-hmm. to the true house of God, to the true temple. Verse 17, but after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. Mm-hmm. They who abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols, so wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt. This is quite swift. Mm-hmm. Yet he sent as a background to history, he had sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord. Though they testified against them, they would not listen. Then the Spirit of God came on Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you. Now, that's kind of obvious, and it isn't that from Jehoiada, and yet they've turned totally. So they because they are kind of looking, I guess, at the covenant being with Jehoiada, not with, in general.
Well, and like we.
So it looks like Zechariah followed Jehoiada.
Mm-hmm. Yes, his father. Mm-hmm. He did.
Yes.
And God.
Yes.
Well, I mean, in the society.
What's that picture of when Paul says, follow me as I follow the mm-hmm. Lord? And we say, I follow Paul. I'm not following Paul. I'm following Paul as he follows the Lord.
Yeah, I was just trying to get the succession of priests as they.
Yes.
Right. And also that this is somebody that Joash grew up with.
Right.
So now
the son. As a brother.
Yes.
Is Zechariah the priest to Judah or to Israel? I forget.
Judah. It's Jehoiada's son. And Jehoiada is the priest of Judah. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord. Number one, they wouldn't even kill Athaliah there, because you don't desecrate the temple. and they killed a righteous man. Do they not think that this is going to come on their heads? Verse 22, thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness of his father, and God calls him his father, Jehoiada, that had shown him, but he murdered his son and he died. He said, may the Lord see and avenge. That is where the Old Testament is different than the New.
And now we see the...
Well, it goes back to the avenger of the blood.
Right.
And now we see...
But we don't... They didn't have the blood that covered it all yet.
No.
The atonements were atonement to atonement, the situation to situation, the sin offering to sin offering, the guilt offering to guilt offering, and they keep perpetuating it because the one who has the final offering has not yet come.
Right.
Now, it happened in the turn of the year that the army of the Arameans came up against him, and they came to Judah and Jerusalem. They destroyed all the officials of the people from among the people and sent their spoil to the king of Damascus. Indeed, the army of the Arameans came with a small number of men, yet the Lord delivered a very great army into their hands. Pay attention, guys. This was obviously the Lord, because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash.
Mm-hmm.
Who's they that executed judgment?
The
Syrians. Or Armenians.
And who did they execute for?
God.
For the Lord.
God.
When they
God
had departed Lord. From him, for he left him very sick, his own servants conspired against him. Why? And this is where we're told. Because of the blood of the son of Jehoiada the priest. That's why his servants turned on him and murdered him in his bed. So he died. See, this is where we get the picture that God can see and nobody else can see. He died and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tomb of the kings, which is so sad because he had been a good king up to that point.
But the Jehoiada was buried with the kings. And
yes,
that's the contrast.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The king was not buried with the king.
This is what I want to read to you. And don't focus on the wrong things in this. This is a real story because it was something both Ken and I saw happen from different places. Back in the hippie days that turned into where the Jesus freaks came in, there was a lot of immorality that would be cleaned through. And this is written by a man named Michael Frost about, he's writing a book called Seven Broken Men. And one of the seven was a man named Lonnie Frisbee. It says, if you like Eric Metzke's 2013 book, Seven Men, you're probably not going to care for my current series, Seven Broken Men, about the fragile and unlikely people God has used to glorify himself. And this is where I think about Jehu. To glorify himself, you can find my first post in the series here. But if you're up for it, put on your old Larry Norman or Keith Green records. It's time to hit the beaches of Southern California in the 1960s to meet the remarkable but ultimately tragic hippie preacher Lonnie Frisbee. Maybe Lonnie Frisbee could have grown up to be a cult leader or a serial killer if Jesus hadn't gotten a hold of him. His early life pretty much mirrored that of his contemporary and fellow Californian Charles Manson. Frisbee grew up in an unstable home where he was exposed to the dark underbelly of the 1960s California society. He was sexually assaulted as a child and introduced to drugs in his teens. At 15, he had his first homosexual encounter, which ultimately ushered him into the Laguna Beach gay scene. School didn't much like that. Was an art scene. The Laguna Beach scene was an art scene. School didn't much. Didn't take much of a priority, so by the time he was 18, he headed north to San Francisco with thousands of flower children for the Summer of Love in 1967. He could barely read and write. Lonnie Frisbee was a hippie straight out of the Central Casting. good-looking, wide-eyed, and mystical. He talked vaguely about becoming an artist or a dancer, but he wasn't good at either, and he wasn't. He was a bad artist. He was a bearded, long-haired dreamer. People said he looked like Jesus. He preferred to describe himself as a nudist vegetarian hippie. He tried his hand at hypnotism and dabbled in the occult. He talked incessantly about UFOs. He was pretty much unemployable. This mattered little in California in the late 60s and early 70s. Charles Manson, Hunter S. Thompson, I don't know who that is, and the Weather Underground all managed to exist with no visible means of support, and so did Lonnie Frisbee. But things took a different, slightly different turn when Frisbee led a group of drug-addled friends on an LSD-fueled pilgrimage into a desert outside of Palm Springs. Someday I'll tell you about those people. Things could have gotten real crazy, they did for Manson, in the same desert, but for a faithful trip he took to Takahs Canyon, Frisbee started reading the Gospel of John to everyone, and before they knew, he was baptizing his cadre of stone hippies in the Takahs Falls. Picture that. Is that not weird or what? It also was going on all over the place. An evangelist had been born. At first, the gospel, according to Lonnie Frisbee, included getting high, talking about flying saucers, and reading the Bible. But he soon fell in with other Christians who directed him to a more conventional path. After stints in Haight-Ashbury and Novato, Frisbee landed back in Costa Mesa, where he had grown up. He met a young woman, he got married, and he joined Chuck Smith's Calvary Chapel and started to straighten up and fly right, kind of. The thing was, Lonnie was gay and filled with the Holy Spirit. Now, that's a dichotomy that I can't explain to you, okay? I'm not trying to, and that's not what I'm talking about here. That's a whole other discussion. He would walk the beaches during the day, converting young people seemingly at will. Then he would bring them back to the nightly church services for the lashings of groovy Christian fellow folk music and intense Bible study. Afterwards, he would dispense the Holy Spirit, leaving the room looking like a battlefield as young people hit the floor, began to shake and speaking in tongues. He was a freak, a Jesus freak, and soon became a leading light of the so-called Jesus people, an organic movement of converted hippies, and surfers that sprang out of Calvary Chapel. He went on to exercise direct influence over people like Chuck Smith Jr., Greg Laurie, John Wimber, Mike McIntosh, Derek Prince, and Bob Mumford. In fact, whether it is the charismatic movement, the vineyard, the shepherding movement, the contemporary Christian music scene, or Calvary Chapel itself, Lonnie's fingerprints were all over it. He was no ordinary hippie anymore, but he was no ordinary Christian evangelist either. His marriage had broken down in 1973, and he had started having sexual liaisons with men again. The high places are still up. Frisbee was tortured by it all. He was clearly touched by the hand of God, but he believed his sexuality was a sin. He would speak openly about the challenge of keeping his desires under check. But the dissonance between his beliefs and the evidence of the spirits present in his life and his sexual desires caused him overwhelming stress. He was eventually asked not to be so open in public about his struggles with same-sex attraction. Later still, he became estranged from the very movement he had helped launch. He was marginalized from the Jesus people and later written out of the histories of that period of Southern California Christianity. He contracted AIDS in the 1990s, and he died in 1993. Chuck Smith, his original pastor at Calvary Chapel, preached at Lonnie's funeral and compared him to the wild, marauding brute Samson, a man used by God despite his sinfulness. Lonnie's closest friends took offense. He was no brute, they said. He was a fragile flower crushed by a church that couldn't make room for him. I'm not sure Lonnie would have seen it that way. Today it is reckoned that the Jesus Revolution of the 60s and 70s surpassed even the Great Awakening as the greatest ingathering of souls in American history. And dear, fragile, weird little Lonnie was right there at the beginning, unremembered and unlauded, expunged from the histories of the very movements he was used by God to launch. And that, my friends, is because he didn't deal with the high places. And that's why I call us to deal with the high places, that we may finish well. Lonnie did not finish well. It's not done till it's done. Lord God, we come before you. We think of Joash, we think of Jehu, we think of those whose stories you teach us of and whose lives are examples to us for many different things. And Father, you teach us that if we continue allowing the high places, they will come back into our lives and we will worship again at the wrong altar. Show us our high places, Lord. Set us free from the bondage of sin and death. In the name of your Son. Amen.